I'm going to pass out a couple of things here. Carl, if you wouldn't mind. The first is a sort of a summary sheet from Wednesday night and is connected with some of the things that we have been talking about. I also have a couple of articles that I had mentioned to you that are connected with our topic here. You might turn in your Bibles to Revelation, the 20th chapter. Revelation 20, although we're going to be jumping around some other passages connected with Revelation 20. One of them is an article I mentioned to you about a school in San Antonio, Texas, that is suing the school board because the school system has given students an ID card to show to get into the building, which lots of schools have, and has a number on it. And they say that this is a locator chip for the mark of the beast. So you can pass that around and take a look at it. And I have mentioned ministries that capitalize on this business of dispensationalism, and I just got this in the mail. This is a minister by the name of Tony Alamo, who some of you might recognize, big church. And it's a church that is built upon the image of the beast. And I'll pass that around. You can take a look at it. There's some notes on there from a prisoner who sent that to me. Our prison ministry, we get all kinds of people with all kinds of issues and questions. And one of the things that we talked about on Wednesday night was the fact that the 20th chapter of the book of Revelation is probably the most misunderstood book in the Bible. That is because denominations have used it as a means of building things like this ministry of Tony Alamo's. The passage is called the Rapture Passage. And if you read through the 20th chapter, and we'll read through part of it, you'll see that it talks about a number of symbols that we have talked about in our class. Again, this is Revelation 20, beginning with verse 1. And I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss, and holding in his hand the great chain. He seized the dragon, the ancient serpent. Who is Satan? Is the devil or Satan? And bound him for 1,000 years. He threw him into the abyss and locked and sealed it over him to keep him from deceiving the nations anymore until the 1,000 years were ended. And after that, he must be set free for a short time. And then they usually jump down to verse 7. When the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out and deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to battle them for battle. The number they are like the sand on the seashore. They marched across the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of God's people. And they usually stop right there. On the sheet that I just gave to you, there is an interpretation that denominations make about this event. And I've tried to spell that out, some of these things we talked about on Wednesday night. And I had a few questions that were raised, not only about Wednesday night, but also about the lesson this morning, as we talked about Easter and Good Friday and the Sabbath and things of that type. So I want to try and answer some of these questions tonight. First of all, remember that a lot of what is discussed here on this sheet on the rapture is taken not entirely from the book of Revelation, but is also taken from the book of Thessalonians. And we'll see if you remember anything from that discussion, those of you who were with us. 1 Thessalonians, the 4th chapter. So you might keep one finger in our passage on Revelations and turn back over to 1 Thessalonians 4, beginning with verse 13. The first thing that the people who present this concept of dispensationalism claim is that there will something be called the rapture when Jesus comes and The righteous dead will be raised, and the living saints will be snatched off the earth, transformed, and all the saved will meet the Lord in the air. Now that statement is taken from 1 Thessalonians 4, beginning with verse 13, and specifically it deals with verse 15. According to the Lord's own word, we tell you that we who are alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, will certainly not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will come out of heaven with a loud command, with a loud shout, some translations say, and the voice of the archangel and the trumpet and the call of God, and the dead in Christ will raise first. And after that, we who are alive and are left will be caught up with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. Okay, that's where they get the rapture, right there in that passage. Anybody remember what we said on Wednesday night as to why that is not talking about something called the rapture? Anybody remember anything? Is this a discussion of what the book of Revelation is teaching us? What is Thessalonians? What is the purpose of this passage? You go back and look at verse 13. What does the author in verse 13 of 1 Thessalonians 4 tell us is the purpose of what he's saying? So you won't be ignorant about what? About those who have fallen asleep and those who grieve like the rest of men who have no hope. So according to the guy that wrote this, the purpose is not to talk about the fall of Rome, is not to talk about anything connected with what we have looked at in the first 20 chapters of the book of Revelation, is to encourage the Christians who are living in that time to look forward to where they're going to spend eternity. It's not even the same subject. It certainly is not dealing specifically with any denominational creed of this type. And it's kind of interesting because when you go back and you read the 20th chapter of Revelation, what you see is there is nothing said about the second coming of Christ. That whole business about the living being taken off the earth, being snatched off the earth, Jesus' second coming is not in that. That's not what it's talking about. It's talking about the events that occur on earth when the end of time comes. So it doesn't even deal with the next, with the stated claim. So it's a misapplication of what 1 Thessalonians is discussing. They're two different books. They're dealing with two different topics. Revelation is a prophecy book. Thessalonians is a book dealing with doctrine of the church, with things that happen within the church. Now, the second thing that's supposed to happen, according to dispensationalists, is that there will be a time of great tribulation on the earth. And they take Matthew 24 for this. So let's go back to Matthew 24. And I'm glad I'm not glad that Richard is sick, but I'm glad we had a little time for an extra class here right in the middle of our study of Revelation, because it's a good time for us to look at some of these ideas that are involved with this. So they use Matthew 24, specifically with verse 15. And it's kind of interesting that they take one passage here because there's a reference here, and the reference is going to have to lead us to another passage. The reference is to Daniel. Notice he says, "So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. And let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." That's Jesus speaking. And so they refer us to Daniel. Now, we will go to that in a minute, but I want you to look at verse 21. Because here's where the word is used. And we could spend a month looking at what this prediction of Jesus is about. But in verse 21, "For then there will be great tribulation," or some translations say distress, "unequated from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again." And if you read through that whole passage, the term tribulation is used. It's also used in Mark 13 and 24, dealing with the same result. Now, as you look at that, and you may have a Bible that has headings on it, is this a prophecy of the end of the creation? Is this a judgment prophecy? It isn't, is it? As a matter of fact, what Jesus is doing here is telling them what will happen at the end of the age. If you go back to verse 3, he says, when this will happen, and what will be the sign of your coming in the end of the age? Well, what age is he talking about? You read on through here, and you'll see the prophecy that is being given is a prophecy that has to deal with the destruction of Jerusalem. And we know that the Romans came in and destroyed Jerusalem not too long after this. Now, let's go back to Daniel for a minute. Let's see what they do with this prophecy in Daniel, because that's the one that he referred to in Matthew 24 and verse 15. So let's go back. And I know we're jumping around a lot here. We won't keep doing this, but I wanted to spend a few minutes with some of these verses. And in Daniel, the 9th chapter, this is what Jesus refers to. I always have these little prophets have trouble getting my Bible to open to them. Daniel, the 9th chapter, starting with verse 20. And I'll read this because this is what Jesus is quoting, but then I want us to look at the context again of the passage. You know, one of the things that you always have to do is to look at the context of what is written. Again, this is Daniel 9, beginning with verse 20. While I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and making my request to the Lord my God from its holy hill, while I was still in prayer, Gabriel, the man I had seen in the earlier vision, came to me in swift flight about the time of the evening sacrifice. He instructed me, saying to me, Daniel, I have now come to give you insight and understanding. As soon as you begin to pray, an answer was given, which I have come to tell you, for you are highly esteemed. Therefore, consider the message and understand the vision. And then he starts with a group of high symbols again. Notice 77s. We've talked about how 7 is used. 77s are the decreed for your people in your holy city to finish transgressions, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up vision and prophet, and to anoint the most holy. And he goes on through. The next verse says, no one understand this from the issue of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the appointed one. And my Bible has capital A in appointed. The ruler who comes will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens, and it will be rebuilt. Okay, he goes, that's the passage Jesus is talking about. Now, the question is Daniel, is this passage in Daniel a prophecy of the end of the earth? Go back and look at verse 1 of this chapter. You know, anytime people come up with a bizarre interpretation of the Bible, the best thing to do is to read the whole chapter. Go back and look at the context. And so let's take this chapter, which we just read the prophecy they quote from, and let's go back and see what this is about. Chapter 9, again, of Daniel, starting with verse 1. In the first year of Darius, the son of Xerxes, a Mede by descent, who was made ruler over a Babylonian kingdom, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood from scriptures, according to the word of the Lord given to Jeremiah the prophet, that the desolation of Jerusalem would last 70 years. Now, we can stop right there. We can keep reading if you wish. But what is the context? What is this passage in Daniel about, according to that verse? Is it about the judgment? It's Jerusalem. What had happened? You know the history of Israel. Israel had forsaken God. The result of that was that they were overtaken by their enemies. And you know the story of Nebuchadnezzar and so forth. And if you go back, you don't have to go back very far. Go back to chapter 7, and you have Daniel's dream of the four beasts. And you go back to chapter 6, and you've got Daniel in the lion's den. Now, you know that history. So what is being prophesied is the destruction of Jerusalem. It's not the same subject as the book of Revelation. So it's important to understand that, and I went through this fast on Wednesday night, and I guess I went through too fast for something. I said, well, where does the tribulation thing come from? It comes from Matthew, specifically Matthew 24, 21, but the prophecy they use is Matthew 24, 15, which goes back to Daniel, and the prophecy they're using in Daniel, according to the guy that wrote it, is a prophecy about Jerusalem. I hope that makes that a little bit more clear. I have listed here the other steps of dispensationalism. And you may notice some of these. Number three, Jesus and the Savior return to earth, where Jesus will set up his physical kingdom, sit on David's throne, and rule from Jerusalem for 1,000 years. What did Jesus say? My kingdom is not of this world. Jesus strongly denies any attempt to make a political kingdom out of his situation. And I have this written down at the bottom here. You'll notice I have 8 points listed at the bottom. Nowhere in the 20th chapter of Revelation is there a mention of Jesus reigning physically on the earth, setting up a physical kingdom. And the notion that Jesus would engage in war, what did Jesus tell Peter when Peter started to defend him when Judas and his buddies came to arrest Peter? What did he say? Arrest Jesus. What did Peter say? What did Jesus say to Peter? All right, put away your sword, because he who lives by the sword dies with the sword. That's not the kind of guy that's going to start a major war. Okay? And step number four, the Jews will be converted, returned to Palestine, and the basics of Old Testament worship will be established. And the Jews, that the 144,000 Jews that are brought back are supposed to be soldiers that will destroy the Arabs and the other people of that time that oppose the Christian system. And again, this is a repeat of what we did on Wednesday night, but I hope that maybe that helps a little bit with those of you that are struggling, where some of your friends and neighbors come up with some of these ideas and why we don't believe that is a right approach. Cynthia raised a question this morning. She said, in your sermon, you didn't explain something that is a big problem for a lot of people. And I appreciate her bringing this to my attention. Supposedly, Jesus was executed on Good Friday. Now, this is we're out of Revelation here for just a minute. We're just doing sort of a question and answer thing. A Good Friday. And I said, we talked about where Good Friday came from, that actually is not good at all, but that this is a German word that was copied and used to apply to a day that really was a special day to the early Christians, but was not good. But if he was crucified on Friday, then there's another place where it says that Jesus was in the tomb 3 days and 3 nights. And if you count up Friday to Saturday, Saturday to Sunday, you end up with 2, not 3. And so the question is there a big conflict? I want you to notice the answer to this. It turned to John, the 19th chapter. I should have done this in the sermon this morning. I was trying to watch the clock. I had a note to do this, but when I've got people taking care of kids downstairs, I don't want to leave them at the mercy of the kids for too terribly long. So I didn't want to run too far over. But I want you to notice John 19, verse 31, because there's a key word in this verse that people miss, and it's the explanation of what goes on here. Again, this is John 19, starting with verse 31. Now it was the day of preparation, and the next day was to be what? The special Sabbath. The special Sabbath. What is a special Sabbath? First of all, what's a Sabbath? What does Sabbath mean? I'm sorry? Saturday? That might be when it is, but that's not what the word means. Rest. It means rest or withdrawal. It means rest. And actually, as I mentioned to you this morning, the Passover period, they had 8 days of rest. Okay? And we read that this morning. They had a special session at the beginning, a special session at the end, and they had 8 days of rest in between. The special Sabbath, however, the regular special Sabbaths, were an extra rest day. Sort of like 4th of July, you know? If you get off for 4th of July weekend, how many days do you get off? 1 day plus the weekend. You get 3 days, right? You get an extra day because of the special day, okay? And the same thing's true of Memorial Day and so forth and so on. The Jews had a special Sabbath, which meant that they were in Sabbath on Friday, Saturday, and the double period. So there were two Sabbaths. So Jesus was crucified on Thursday. There's mountains of evidence to that. But the special Sabbath, that's what it says. I mean, we're just looking at what the Bible says. The Bible says it was a special Sabbath. That means he was crucified on Thursday. not on Friday. I know that's what tradition says, and that's, you know, the Catholic Church bought into that because of the fact that it fitted the pagan holidays of the time. But the point is, that's not when it actually happened. So you have Friday and Saturday, and then the resurrection. And that works. So the key word there is special. There was a special Sabbath, and verse 31 makes that abundantly clear. It's not a big issue for most of us, but people who like to nitpick at the Bible and like to say, well, the Bible's got a lot of mistakes in it, that's one of the things they'll pick on. And the point is, you've got to study a little more than that if you're going to raise that kind of question. Any other questions on that? All right, well, let's pick up a nice discussion then. And we talked a little bit about this, began this discussion on Wednesday night, but let's turn to Revelation 21. We've got two chapters left. We hope to finish this whole study by Wednesday night. Right, and we spent most of our time on Wednesday night talking about what it does mean. Well, what happens with it? When the angel seizes the dragon, what happens? He's thrown into the abyss, okay? And if you go back, those of you that have the sheets, this is the one that says at the top, Book of Revelation chapters 20-21 is where we are in that discussion. Satan is put into this. Then we have the release of Satan. And if you remember, we spent some time talking about what happens in verse 7. When the 1,000 years were over, Satan was released from his prison to go out and deceive the nations in the corners of the earth, Gog and Magog. We talked about the historical part of Gog and Magog. These were enemies from the Old Testament of God. And to gather them for battle. So we've got the ultimate battle going on here. They are like the sand in the seashore. Why? Because these are everybody who opposed God. Old and New Testament. Like the sands of the seashore. A lot of people that opposed God. They marched across the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of God's people, the city he loves. And we're about to discuss that city here. That's where we're headed right now, chapter 21. But what happened? According to this passage, latter part of verse 9, what did God do? Fire came down and destroyed him. That's it. We are not given a blow-by-blow description because God doesn't mess around. What happens is, they are destroyed. So all of the people that had opposed God are destroyed. What happens to Satan, according to verse 10? He's cast in the lake of fire where the beast and the false prophet have been thrown. And that we had discussed from the previous chapters. We know where what the beast is. We know what the false prophet is. They are taken and they are done away with. And then we start in verse 11 with the judgment picture. And it's very simple. And this passage, the first part of the last part of verse 20 is very simple. You have the great white throne. We've talked about that. That is the judgment picture. Seated upon it, the earth and sky fled from his presence. There was no place for them. So we have the destruction of the earth. We have the destruction of space. And then I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne. The books were opened. And another book was opened, the book of life. And we talked about what the book of life is. Everybody whose name is written in the book of life. And those in heaven, verse 15 particularly, brings that up because it goes on through. And in the last verse, it says, if anybody's name was not found in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. But what I tried to emphasize Wednesday night was that death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. So there's no more death. All of the things that have been the affliction of man are destroyed. So 20 is a very, very clear, easy book because the first thing that happens is Satan is restricted. Then the final battle takes place where Satan is destroyed. And that's in one verse. But fire came down from heaven and devoured them. So all those who had opposed God are devoured. That's the ultimate fate of people who reject God. And the source of all this, Satan and his angels, everybody that had been a part of the spiritual kingdom of rejecting God, and we could go back to Ephesians 6:12 if you want to, which talks about that, they were thrown into the lake of fire. The judgment scene, we're going to see more about, But in verses 11 through 15, we have the negatives. The dead are just according to what they have done as recorded in the books. Where did they come from? The next verse, verse 13, the sea gave up the dead that were in it, death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them, and each person was judged according to what he has done. So we have the judgment picture. But the most important part of the judgment picture is what we're getting to now, and that is the New Jerusalem. That's chapter 21, which is where we're hoping to pick up here tonight. Well, you have two stages. In the part that we just read, in verses 7 through 10, we have the destruction of the spiritual beings. In verses 11 through 15, we have the destruction of those who were humans living upon the earth. It says specifically, each person was judged according to what he has done. So that sort of narrows it down. In chapter 21, we have another description in the first seven verses. And I have a question I want you to think of, and I hope that this comes really clear to you. How do you know that what we're about to read does not refer to Jesus returning to Jerusalem to set up a physical throne on David's throne? And let's read it. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. Now we might stop right there. This is a new heaven and a new earth. Everything is gone. Why? Well, remember what we had back up in verse 11. Verse 11 said, and I saw the great white throne. And we've talked about the throne scene. And him who was seated on it, and the earth and sky fled from his presence. So there's no earth. There's no space. Everything is completely and totally done away with. What happens next? We have a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth passed away. We know why. We just read it. And there was no longer any sea. That's all gone. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. Okay, so this is coming from heaven. And then this picture that we've seen before, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. Do you remember where we saw that before? I know I'm dumping a lot on you here. Go back to chapter 19. Just two chapters back. And look down, starting with verse, 7. What does verse 7 say? See if we can remember things here. Let us rejoice and be glad. Why? The wedding of the Lamb has come. Who's the Lamb? Jesus Christ. And who's the bride? Church. How do you know that? We'll keep reading. Fine linen, bright and clean, was given to her to wear. And you read right on, fine linen stands for the righteous acts of the saints. There's no interpretation here. John tells us what it is. So in chapter 21, we're being brought back to this scene of the wedding. And Revelation 19, verses 1 through 10, gives us a description of this. So the first thing that happens is, heaven and earth are gone. So you can't talk about Jesus ruling from Jerusalem on David's throne because the earth is gone. Space is gone. It's a new heaven and a new earth. That's not my opinion. That's what verse 20, the first one of 21 says. You say, well, tell me about that. I'm in the flesh just like you are. It's so beautiful we can't imagine it. So beautiful we can't conceive of it. Our minds simply can't go beyond the physical existence that we have. And so there's all kinds of wonderful descriptions here. I mean, if you jump over, and we're going to do this, probably not tonight, but we're going to go over and look at this. When the city is described, jumping over to verse 18, the wall was made of jasper and the city of pure gold, pure as glass. The foundations of the city were decorated with every kind of precious stone. First foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth emerald, the fifth, well, so forth. You know, can you visualize anything like that? I don't think so. No, we're physical beings. We're limited to what we can perceive. And what's being said, in my opinion, is not that we're going to actually have a city made out of gold and sapphire and chalcedony and so forth, but it's saying this is so beautiful. This is the best we can do for your limited human mind to explain how wonderful it's going to be. Well, when you say up there,
up in heaven with him.
What do you mean by up there? Now, by the way, I pick on Rose because I have known Rose for a long time, so don't feel that I will do this to everybody. But which way is up? How do you know it's not that way? If you're on the other side of the earth, you'd be pointing that way. Yeah, but if you're on the other side of the earth, Sydney's going to be the other side of the earth on Friday. What is the up and down business about? When we say up, God is up there. Why do we say, what are we talking about? All right, he's everywhere, but he's not confined to down here, is the point. Okay? I don't know what you visualize when you pray. Do you visualize an old man? I hope not. You know, Acts 17 says, in him we live and move and have our being. That's the nature of God. It's not a place up there in the sense of being on the moon or being on the sun or being in another galaxy or something of that type. Because this earth and this space is gone. But up there is the word I'm responding to. When you say up there, you know, that fan is up there.
No, not far enough.
Not far enough. But the point is you can't go far enough to reach heaven. Yeah, that's it. You remember the Russian astronaut Gagarin, the first man in space? Somebody asked him, do you believe in God? And he said, no, I didn't see him when I was in orbit. What's he looking for? Physical God. Yeah, he's looking for a man. And it's important to understand, if you go, we're going to do this, but if you go over to chapter 22 and you start reading the description of what heaven is like in verse 22, there's all kinds of descriptions that are like as. Okay? He goes down the streets, the great street of the city, and there's a tree bearing 12 crops of fruit, like as. And he goes on, this whole description is describing to us a condition that is spiritual, not physical. And I'll tell you one thing, I don't want to be back in a body like this. I got enough arthritis. I don't want any more. I don't want any more falling on the carpet and seeing blood fly everywhere. Right, Dave? Don't want any more of that. And the interesting thing is, when you read on into the last part of this chapter and the next chapter, well, verse 23 of this chapter, the city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it. Because the glory of God gives it light. We're going to get into that, but that's because all those physical things are gone. The sun's gone. Moon's gone. Everything's gone. It's a spiritual condition. Everything is back to the energy from which it came. You're looking ahead, but let's remind ourselves of something. What's 12? What's 12? Remember our symbology? 12 is the organized religion God has given man. And we have 12 in the Old Testament, 12 in the New Testament. What's the 12 in the Old Testament? 12 tribes of Israel. What's 12 in the New Testament? The 12 apostles. And the city that we're seeing here has 12 gates on one side, 12 gates on the other side. And if you read the passage, it says the 12 gates are of the Old Testament and the 12 other gates are of the New Testament, of the apostles. It's again, that's back to those symbols. You got to know the symbols. And it's interesting. We'll see this when we get into this. But, you know, it even talks about how big the city is. And it says it's 1,200 stadia long. You know how much 1,200 stadia is? It's 1,400 miles. 1,400 miles. Is that what it's saying? This is chapter 21. We're jumping way ahead here. You can blame Rose for that. Chapter 12, verses 15. Yeah, I'm having trouble with these little words. 15, 16, 17, 18, right in there. It has walls 144 cubits thick. That's about 200 feet thick. Why do you need a wall that thick? Well, that's not the point. The 144, 12 times 12, there we go again. You know, again, you go back to the symbols. What is it trying to say to us? It's trying to say to us that this was complete. This is God's complete will for man. And this city, this new Jerusalem, is a place that's so wonderful you don't want to miss it. And maybe that's a good place for us to stop tonight because we're about out of time. But I think it's important to recognize that this description of the new Jerusalem and this description of heaven says to you, this is something you don't want to miss. What's our song? If you take it physically, it also tells you the city is a cube, that it's that high. Why do you need a city that's 2,000 miles high? That puts you clear off the earth and up near the moon, you know? It's a symbol. It's a real good proof that it's a symbol. No. And I'm back, you and Rose, you know? No. It isn't a physical thing. It's a spiritual significance. And we'll pick that up on Wednesday. What's their song number? Number 540? 543. So turn to 543. And the song is Redeemed. We know the song well. And that's what our theme is here. We're talking about the fact we want to be redeemed to be in that city we were just talking about. Let's stand together and let's sing this song. If you have a need you'd like to bring to us, come to the front and express that, please.